All right, welcome back to another edition of the Sunstone Podcast. I'm your host, John Larson, and I'm here with... Sometimes I get to talk... Oh, I always get to talk to amazing people, but sometimes I get to talk to people who I really admire.
Oh.
And today, I'm getting to talk to Natasha. Natasha, welcome to the Sunstone Studios.
I am so happy to be here. Thank you, John. And it's, what a nice introduction.
It's fun. You've been in town. We had the Sunstone Conference this last weekend.
Yeah.
And you've been out pollinating the flowers around and talking, giving
That's
presentations.
Right.
you're a celebrity in the state of Utah now, right?
Maybe. Yeah, nobody knows who I am in Kansas, but it's fun to come to Utah and get recognized every now and then. That's super fun.
Now, if you don't mind saying, what part of Kansas do you live in?
I live in Wichita, Kansas.
I spent the worst hour of my life.
Oh, no.
at 8,000 feet above Wichita.
In tornado land?
It was,
what?
Yes, it was a summer storm, and I was in a plane trying to land, and it was too stormy for us to land.
Oh.
So we just kept circling the city for an hour.
Oh, that's awful.
I have never, it's the biggest display of religion I've ever seen. And I've never seen that many people throw up on a plane. You know, normally you don't see people throw up on a plane. Those bags, they're there for a reason.
Oh, that's awful. And I'm so sorry.
So, but Wichita, I've been there 3 or 4 times. It is a lovely place. I love it.
It's not bad. It's you take a drive like northeast and you hit the Flint Hills really quickly, and it's actually quite beautiful. There's been astounding times that I'm like just in awe of the beauty of Kansas and the sunsets and the fields, and I think about the pioneers and, you know, I get all romantic about it. And then there's other times I'm totally bored. So, you know, it's one of those things.
I think it's probably true with every place, you know.
Yes.
I think people move to some of like, you know, places like San Francisco or New York City, and they think it's going to be exciting, but they forget that everything costs money.
Oh, yeah.
So those cities can be pretty boring too if you have a normal income.
But just so you know, I'm very seriously considering moving out here. So probably within hopefully 6 months to a year to at most 2 years. So I'm really excited to get back into this space.
I love it out here for a couple reasons. I actually left the state. As I've talked about before, I moved as far as I could get. I moved to the East Coast, and I just finished grad school. I wanted a new take on things, but it was really to kind of escape Mormonism, move out. Of course, I famously started the old podcast when I was out of the States. And as everyone who escapes Utah will tell you, the biggest problem with doing that is you spend all your vacation time coming back here.
Right.
So if you don't like Utah, it's not going to help, you know, if you've got family and all that kind of stuff here.
Right.
But I think, and I've told a lot of people this, you know, they sometimes, a lot of people leave the church and they have great relationships with their neighbors and that sort of stuff after. But there's those who struggle. And the number one thing is just to move anywhere in the state. Move, just make sure you get to a different stake. And then then you're just a non-Mormon and they just kind of ignore you. And I was talking to some friends last night. I was saying, you know, I've lived in the state now for 9 years. And I forget it's a Mormon place because, you know, my circle and where I go and where the cities I hang out with are mostly non-Mormon.
Right, right.
And that city is Salt Lake. So
right. You know. It's becoming more diverse, and that's exciting. Yeah, for sure.
It is. So we always have to ask in our culture, of course, for everybody who lives in the mission field, how did you get out there?
Well, I did the classic, you know, Mormon woman thing. You know, you follow your husband's career around. So I've been doing that for the last, you know, 24 years for sure. I was a military brat to begin with, so I never really grew up in Utah, although some of my family now is in this area. But I'm not really a Utah person to begin with. I'm mainly wanting to come back just because I feel so much of my work now is centered here. And I would have a lot more opportunities to present and meet people and network. So that's what I'm excited about.
Well, we love having you here. You've got this, you're one of the people who just kind of gets it, and you can move freely from all the different camps, which most of us can't. There's only a few of you who can. So
nice.
So you are a therapist, a licensed therapist.
Yes.
Tell us what, I can't keep track of all the different credentials. Tell us what your credential is.
Sure. So I got my bachelor's degree in psychology and then went on, as most people need to do in the psych fields, to get my master's degree. And I did that in marriage and family therapy. And then about 15 years into that, I got a certification as a sex therapist. So I have an ASECT certified credential from in regards to sex therapy. So those are the two things that are mainly my credentials in the back of my name.
Now, do you do telemedicine? Do you do therapy across state lines?
Yes. Yeah, so I do, I do teletherapy within states that I am licensed, and I also do online coaching and consultations across state lines when that's appropriate, when that's an appropriate model to follow.
We have a pretty wide reach. What states are you licensed in?
I am licensed in Wisconsin and in Kansas, and then I have several providers who work for me that are licensed in states like Idaho, Utah, Florida, Minnesota.
So if they go to your website, they can find who they need. Let's throw that out right here at the top.
My online practice is called Symmetry Solutions, and you can find us at symmetrysouls.com. You can also find anything that I'm doing and involved in, which tends to be a lot of things, at natashaparker.org. So those are the best places to kind of figure out
what. And you guys have a presence on Facebook too.
We do. We have a Facebook page. We have a blog that we release pretty much weekly with lots of great information. We try to give presentations at Sunstone and other venues. So we love educating and reaching out to people. And one of the issues is geography. I mean, if you're living in Massachusetts or Nigeria or South America, I mean, we've had all those kinds of people reach out to us. It's not like they have a lot of resources that understand faith transition issues and things that they're going through. And so in the ethics of it all, you know, as I think about license requirements and all the things that we're thinking about from a therapeutic standpoint, I also think about the ethics of leaving people abandoned without resources. So that's a lot of what we're trying to meet a need for at Symmetry.
Well, excellent. Fantastic. And they just announced they're doing another Thrive conference in November, November 19th, and you'll be appearing there. That's at the Salt Palace.
That's correct. Yes.
So if you want to see Natasha, you can see her at least in November here in Salt Lake.
Yes. And I'll also be doing a faith transition retreat in Oklahoma City.
Oh, great.
In September. So if anybody's in the Midwest, make sure you check out my website to see if you can register for that.
Okay, fantastic. Well, we were talking, we've talked several times about this kind of stuff, about sex and the Mormon world. And we always start with Mormonism, but let's just say it up front, a lot of the problems that people run into that they would require or benefit from the services of a family therapist or a sex therapist, they're kind of American issues as well as Mormon issues.
Absolutely. I just say we usually have a slightly unique twist, you know, as a Mormon culture where we take some things and put them on steroids. And actually some other things we do, I would say, even better than the mainstream culture. But we definitely, especially in the areas of sexuality, I think have some things that we definitely have a unique take on and unique issues with.
And you can see them come out politically. You know, the United States has a stand. They don't want birth control or sex education going anywhere in the world that we fund. There was a documentary about 10 years ago or so, I remember, where they were on the streets in like Norway or Finland or something, and they asked teenagers for condoms, and they all had them, the boys and the girls, and then they would ask the same question for American teens, and they got answers like, ew, that's gross, and that sort of thing. So Les just seems like I'm beating up on Mormons all the time. I just want to point out that we've got broader cultural issues with sexuality in our American culture.
Very broad, especially in my training to become a sex therapist. It's interesting to hear nationally renowned sex therapists talk about these kinds of issues, and they're definitely not talking about Mormons. They're talking about mainstream Americans, from anything from OBGYNs who are not trained in sexuality to, yes, our school education systems to our legal issues. I mean, it's just rampant our funding, our research, everything that we are about here in the United States is fairly problematic, and that there are many, many countries way ahead of us in regards to statistics, comprehensive sexual education, unwanted pregnancies, lower rates of abortion. Just they're beating us on all kinds of statistics. So.
Well, and that's an important thing. I've told the story before that, you know, when I was single, I tried to get tested, a standard panel of tests every 6 months or so by recommendation from healthcare folks. And it was difficult. They, I'm talking to nurses and doctors, they would viscerally react like you were asking them like to, I don't know. There was definitely a shaming cycle there. They oftentimes fumbled around like they didn't know what to do. One time they completely bumbled my urine test. Like, because the nurses just didn't even know what to do with it in that context, because they had to come in later and apologize that they screwed it up.
They're not able to help women with non-reproductive sexual issues. And so, you know, you've got vaginismus and you've got, you know, arousal disorders, and you've got all kinds of things that women are dealing with perimenopause and menopause and post-menopause, and they just come back with a lot of ideas like, well, that's just all in your head, or it's just fascinating how behind the times we are, and that you really have to look for an OBGYN who has gone beyond their medical training to actually get sexuality training. And those OBGYNs exist, but they're hard to come across, and then they're full, right? So, and depending on your resources, how readily available is that going to be to, you know, for example, a Mormon woman, I don't know, in Idaho, in some small town, right? That's just not going to be a readily available resource. So it's very upsetting and disappointing. I know I had a similar experience with my pediatrician, even, you know, around like HPV vaccines and just basic sexual education. I'm like, yeah, go ahead, tell them about puberty, tell them about the vaccine. Like, I'm a sex therapist. They've had this information from me, and just, even though I think she's relieved, I'm sure she comes across a lot of parents that she has a hard time talking about these things at all with. She stumbles in talking to my kids about it. So it's very interesting.
So that kind of sets the deck for social and other problems in, you know, on both sides of the fence for those who are leaving the church and those who are in the church. I've tended, because I've worked with the population of people leaving the church for a lot longer, so I tend to focus in on their issues. So I apologize up front if I seem like I'm talking about ex-Mormons, but I want to make clear that there's non-Mormons and Mormons and everything in between that struggle with some of these same issues.
Absolutely.
So, you know, I think one of the issues we have in Mormonism, especially starting in the 50s, which was part of a whole American thing, it sort of became more obsessed with sexuality. And I tell you that from my own study of like Mormon manuals. Mm-hmm. I've read a lot of them, Sunday school manuals and priesthood manuals dating back to the 19th century. And the ones in the 20s before the Depression and coming out of the Gilded Age, they were fantastic. They were full of poetry and literature. And, you know, like nobody cared if it was from a Mormon or a non-Mormon. Then the Depression and the war hit, and we kind of culturally did a retrenchment around sexuality. Of course, the Victorians were really concerned about masturbation and some of those things, but there was a resurgence of that in along with the counterculture. I hope I'm not misrepresenting history,
like Kellogg cornflakes is directly related to, you know, trying to keep people from masturbating.
Dr. Graham, cornflakes were to keep people from masturbating, and so were graham crackers.
Yeah. Some of our favorite foods.
Right. So I have a special fantasy that involves both of those things.
Oh, that's kind of very exciting. Yeah, yeah. Can't wait to hear about that.
I you know, there was that book that came out. Well, Cleon Skousen wrote one, the How to Raise a Boy or something like that. There was a book in the 50s and 60s that was really kind of shockingly anti-sexual. And then, of course, we have some of the Mormon leaders who really fought against sex, like Spencer Kimball and Boyd K. Packer, took it on them to kind of try to correct these problems. Now, in all fairness, I think especially with Kimball, he was a very caring person. And he was assigned as a young member of the 12 to handle all the homosexuals. And I think that what he did is he would ask the homosexuals things like, well, have you ever masturbated? And they, of course, would say yes, because they were human beings. And then he made a conclusion that masturbation caused homosexuality.
That's not unique to Kimball. I mean, that goes that goes back again. I mean, the myths around masturbation include things like blindness and insanity and
hairy
warts and hairy palms and homosexuality. I mean, it's definitely, there have been eras that started, you know, I guess it's even hard to say when they've started, because it seems like it starts with a particular, I don't know, like Catholic priest, but then you go back and you realize actually there was, you know, somebody else from some other religious culture, maybe even 400 years before that, you know, that also had these kinds of ideas. So you've got the sin of Onan, you know, that's been like talked about from masturbatory ways, even though it has nothing to do with masturbation. I mean, there's just so many different places where these kinds of mythologies come from that it's not surprising that Kimball, you know, was influenced by all of that history. And
of course he was a product of his time.
Right.
So I grew up I was a child in the 70s and kind of came of age in the 80s. And there was a lot of sex shaming, of wrapping our identity of, are you a good teacher? Are you a good priest? Are you a good young woman around your attitudes about sex? I look back now, having been out of the church for a while, and it's amazing to me just how much we talked about sex all the time, and oftentimes couched in strange terms like petting or what's always heavy petting. I guess light petting is okay.
Well, and chastity and modesty, and of course the everlastingly wonderful one that they just came up with, which is virtue. So these words that really are much more abstract than anything to do with sexuality, and yet they have very sexual meanings in the LDS culture. So when the young women's, you know, what do they call it? The values included virtue. I was, you know, that was just several years ago. I was really shocked to see that. That's how we were going to now use that word to mean virginity, really.
Yes. And of course, the word morality, I've pointed this out before, almost is synonymous with, yes, with sexuality for Mormons.
Yes. Where you're at church and they're talking about sexual, or they're talking about, we live in an immoral world. I don't think anybody's like thinking about
wage disparity.
Yes. Or exploitation of like nail salon workers, right? Or something. I mean, they're thinking about sexuality. That we have a lot of code words that you get to think about sex a lot on Sunday at Sunday school and in sacrament meeting for sure.
Well, the two ones that really rub me the wrong way are worthy, because worth means value. And then of course the other one is values. We talk about the young women's values. That I think the danger is Mormon theology sort of built itself around this idea that our worth, especially the worth of a female, is around her sexual potential. And her sexual potential is spent once she has sex. And we, you know, we have the chewed gum, we have the nailed board. Do we, everybody's heard those. We don't have to define those out, do we?
I wouldn't think so. I had a brownie one that was very disturbing because she said that there was poop in the brownies and who wanted a brownie, and I still wanted one. And so it kind of like did a lot more than sexually shame me, eating disordered shame me.
The oven's 350 degrees. That should kill everything. Oh, go ahead. I'll take one. I'm hungry.
They smelled really good. I don't think she put poop in them. I think she was just going to take them home and feed them to her family.
I'm sure of it. So, but those words, when you say worthy, the problem is that there's, for a lot of people, they suffered immensely, and I've heard this from other people, and you know, I'll confess the world, because I've already confessed this. For me, you know, it was a standard struggle with masturbation when I was a young man. But it wasn't that so much as the paradox of repentance. Because the Mormons teach that once you commit a sin again, all the previous sins come back at you. And by the time I was 19 or 20, you know, I was on my mission, I was trying really hard. I really believed I was trying really hard. But I knew I was going to hell. Because I knew that there was no way I could repent from having repented 12 times and then blown through that. Because there was no way for me to overcome, you know, you can repent from something once, but once you do it again and again and again, how do you repent? And I've talked to a lot of Mormons and ex-Mormons. It's funny that most people don't run into that paradox that I ran into, although I see it right there in the teaching.
Yeah. Well, you're talking about something that I thought a lot about. And I mean, I think about it in the terms that we're sinifying normal human behavior that is repetitive in nature because we have a sexual drive. And so, yes, when you are taught that you have to abandon sin and never do it again, but then you're in a body that's going to repetitively ask for something that's very normal and natural and actually healthy for you, but your brain is telling you, God doesn't want me to do this. That's a huge space of like tension to be in with yourself. And it's also, I think, why the sex addiction model is so pervasive in religiously conservative cultures, which with us one being one of them, because you have addiction and kind of seen through this lens of repetitive unwanted behavior. So it's very easy to then buy into that, when in reality, sexuality and your sexual drive is a repetitive need and desire, just like eating and pooping and peeing and burping and farting and all the other things that we do that are repetitive and that are good and healthy for our bodies to be doing. So that is such a huge dilemma, right? Because we have all these people that are having high levels of distress, clinical levels of distress, where now I can actually diagnose you with a mental health disorder, all coming from false sin.
Oh, yes. And I'm seeing more and more of these articles suggesting that you know, we have to talk about the difference between like dependencies and addictions and addictive behaviors, you know, because there's things that you can become addicted to, like alcohol, where if you become a true alcoholic, if you stop drinking, you'll get the DTs. Your body develops a physical dependency on that. Same thing happens with opioids, where you have to have them. But for example, LSD is one that just pops up. There's no evidence that people will develop an addiction to it. They might have a, and you've got the clinical words, a dependency on it, where emotionally, or there's something about their psyche that wants it. You know, it's like I mean, I'm heavy, so I have an eating problem, but no one would argue that I have an addiction to food. I probably have dependencies on unhealthy eating habits.
Well, the addiction language has been hijacked by a lot of different ideologies and theories. I mean, there are people that do believe in food addiction and behavioral dependency, and those are things that we're all kind of struggling to find correct language for, I think, in the mental health community. But even when it comes to like the DSM-5, which is kind of like the Bible of mental health disorders, you really don't find the word addiction in there. You do find substance dependence. And that's exactly what you're talking about, that your body has now become dependent on a chemical that if you stop introducing that chemical, your body is going to have an adverse reaction. And in some cases, that can be lethal. If you stop drinking alcohol, or if you stop certain drugs too quickly, you can actually go into cardiac arrest or, you know, have a really big issue. Caffeine actually made it into that category of substance dependence, which is interesting, with all the energy drinks and Red Bulls and people basically drinking like 50 cups of coffee in one little can that we used to not have available to us before. So when it comes to behaviors and, you know, having this idea that, you know, a drive towards a behavior that obviously helps in some way or another. So I'm like you, you know, I like to eat donuts or things that maybe are not that great for me. I kind of intellectually know that I probably don't want to eat the donut, but then my impulsivity or my desire to calm stress or boredom or whatever it is that I'm trying to calm down, help, you know, leads me towards behavior that maybe I don't want to be engaging in, and I'll eat that donut. And again, I think in most cases, we have some level of fairly good tolerance for that. We don't see ourselves as sick or diseased or, you know, unredeemable. It's just kind of like, okay, well, I'll try again tomorrow, you know, to eat less donuts. And yeah, when it comes to sexual behavior, we, as a culture and even as mental health professionals, and especially even from the legal perspective, we pathologize very quickly. As soon as we're in the land of taboo or what seems to be, quote, abnormal, whoever gets to decide what that is, we start talking about people being sick.
Well, and look at the words we use: dirty, naughty, kinky. Something that's kinked is it doesn't flow correctly.
It's perverse, you know, evil. Mm-hmm. Satan's influence.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, we use words that I was going to say that are associated with filth, but that's another word we use for pornography. Like that's we really in our culture have associated it with the worst parts of what's around, with what's taboo.
Yes.
You know, and there's linguists who say that everything that's taboo has to do with either shitting or f***ing, but which there's another argument that says it's because those are things that remind us that we're animals. So it's taboo to suggest that human beings are animals.
Right.
Well, let's go back to that kind of addiction element, because I mean, it's been said, you know, we don't have sex, sex has us. It's very old. It's the oldest part of us. And it comes before, long before we were ever self-aware, long before most of our cognition, our speech patterns. It is the oldest, deepest part of our brain. And if from a genetic perspective, sex is the very most important thing to pass your genes on, followed only by consumption to stay alive. So that's why it's a struggle to talk about sex addiction, because you're talking about something that is very primal.
Yeah, it also, like I said, pathologizes a very normal aspect of who we are as human beings. And when we think about the addiction model, one of the things that I hear often, especially like in alcoholic circles or things, it's like once an addict, always an addict, you know. And there are even with substances such as alcohol and things like that, there's starting to be some pushback about how we have kind of understood addiction and substance dependence, and are we really going about it the right way? There's not a lot of research that really shows that what we're doing around addiction has been as effective as we'd like to think it is. So we're starting to come across some new research even in that area. But when it comes to sexuality, what I find really difficult to swallow is that any individual would be seeing themselves as diseased because of their sexual behavior, and that now their sexuality is chronically and ongoingly diseased.
Hi, I'm Lindsay Anson Park, Executive Director of the Sunstone Education Foundation. I want to invite you to our weekly Sunstone Firesides. Do you remember those? Firesides that they used to have dating all the way back to the 1930s, when the LDS Church would hold monthly meetings to discuss really important gospel topics. Those meetings became known endearingly as Firesides. In January of 2019, Sunstone launched a new podcast that incorporates a nod to these firesides. Featuring a weekly evening podcast, it will display a range of hosts, all women, as they chat with diverse guests from across the Mormon spectrum. The hosts are all female-identifying that represent a broad perspective in Mormonism. These podcasts will be released every Thursday evening, so you can have that fireside feel brought right into your living room. So grab a cup of cocoa or coffee, since at Sunstone there is more than one way to Mormon. Snuggle up under a blanket and listen to incredible interviews by and from incredible people. You can support women and their work in Mormon studies, which is desperately needed, by donating at sunstone.org or becoming a monthly subscriber. Go to sunstone.org and click on the podcast tab for more info. We hope you enjoy it as much as we do.
So as young Mormon men and women, you have basically three paths you can choose. One, you can try to keep your hands off each other and get married as quickly as you possibly can. And maybe, because we need to define out, there's a natural biological progression that we go through where we see somebody, have an initial attraction, and then that attraction becomes more encompassing and almost like we want to consume the person. Naturally, you start touching more, you get physically aroused, your skin and things around people, and your body is leading you to that moment when you will consummate the relationship.
Yes, and everything that we talk about in regards to dating interrupts that natural progress.
The Mormon dating cycle.
Yeah, or even like the Catholic one, or any religious tradition that really pushes this idea of waiting until that moment of marriage to have sex, right? Because then you are interrupting what would naturally occur if both people were, let's say, you know, mature enough and emotionally secure enough to really go about sexuality in a way that's comfortable to them and consensual and non-exploitative. Then you're right. You know, most people don't necessarily, you know, like meet and kiss and have sex that very first hour. You know, it's like there's a progression, whether that takes days or weeks or months, for those individuals to get to that point. So we interrupt that because we are saying, you know, you're only supposed to do X, Y, and Z before this particular day. And then on that particular day, then I'll hold, you know, then go for it, do whatever you want. So in all of that, it's interrupted. Even in marriage, like, you have couples in Mormon land that barely make it to the temple, right? In other words, they're doing everything. They're dry humping. They're, you know, touching over each other's clothes. They're making out for hours. They're really hot and heavy. And by the time that they get to that marital date, to be naked in front of each other a few hours later probably isn't as huge of a shift as the couples who are holding hands and maybe kissing for the first time across the altar, which happens in our culture as well. And then all of a sudden, within a few hours, they're supposed to be naked and having penis and vagina, you know, penetration. So, yikes.
That's often with no instruction on how to make that happen.
No instruction, no understanding of arousal, no understanding of the human body and anatomy, and especially female arousal and how that all works in regards to female orgasm. And, you know, there's this great book called Becoming Clitorate. So I would say there's no clitorate ability for people to really understand what they're getting themselves into. And so right away, we're interrupting the natural flow of connection. And we do this even in the dating world. I think it's really, we need to stop and think about how harmful it is to interrupt connection and attachment amongst teens and the falling in love process. I can't tell you how many times I hear not just my Mormon counterparts, but even my evangelical counterparts in Kansas be very afraid of their teenagers falling in love. Oh, they're not ready for those emotions. They're going to get their heart broken. They're going to get connected too fast. I wish that they didn't go through high school in a relationship. But what we're not understanding is that that is the age when you start connecting, when you start attaching, when you start falling in love, and they're supposed to go through a few heartbreaks and they're supposed to go through some of those commitments. And so when we interrupt that, say, don't do that at all. Do not date until you're 16, and then only group date until you're 18. So forego any type of attachment or commitment. So stop yourself from doing those things. We don't teach the skills necessary for commitment and attachment that you need in 50-year-old relationships that they're supposedly going to enter just 5 years down the road or 2 years down the road, right? So we are keeping them in bubbles that, and then popping the bubble so quickly that they're ill-equipped to really have long-term relational skills.
Popping the bubble and not transitioning. You know, I think in most indigenous cultures, you know, as an anthropology student, and Mormonism used to be good at this, there was a ceremony, there was a rite of passage that moved you from adolescence to adulthood. And, you know, at that point, oftentimes there was some instruction, but there was this acknowledgement, the community acknowledges you as an adult. And formerly, it was an LDS mission. The reason I say formerly is because the church has dismantled all of the cultural elements around it, like having farewells and having homecomings and really honoring and giving a safe place to leave and a community that welcomes them back in. Mm-hmm. I mean, the church has stripped that away and said, just give a 10-minute talk. But we have nothing like that around sexuality. Mm-hmm. If you're fortunate enough to have a mother as a young woman who and the reason I'm focusing on women is just from the act of masturbation and the nature of our physiology, men are often more comfortable with their bodies, but they're not all the way there than women going into relationships. But I've talked to a lot of friends who, some of them had great mothers or aunts or sisters who gave them a lot of instruction. Others had nothing, just nothing coming into it.
Well, or even worse than nothing, I think, is the well-intentioned female who tells her daughter something along the lines, well, you're probably not going to enjoy it. It's probably not going to be that much fun. It might even hurt, but just soldier through. It'll be fine. It's what your husband needs. And, you know, you need to make sure that you're offering that so that you can have a happy, healthy marriage. That story comes across my office so many times, so that the expectations around sexuality are already completely male-centric, fear-driven, because now you're worried that you're going to experience pain and not satisfying experiences. So a lot of Mormon women, I think, are experiencing less than satisfying sexual experiences, not really understanding their potential for pleasure and for climax, but think that they're fine, think that they're actually having a normal sex life, because that's the expectation that's been taught to them.
Well, and I know for me and my the peers I spoke to as men, there was a lot of anxiety because there was an understanding that female sexuality was complicated. She may or may not bleed. It may or may not hurt. And you didn't want to hurt anybody. And you knew there was this thing called the clitoris, and you had heard rumors Maybe. About this thing called the G-spot.
Maybe.
But it was anxiety driven because you knew you were supposed to perform and take care of this woman, and you had no idea what in the world you were supposed to do.
Oh, we have completely, I think, messed what women and men up fairly equally. I don't think that, I mean, there's obviously differences in genderized messages that we have in our culture, and men suffer in certain ways and women suffer in other ways. But it's really kind of, you know, a shit show for everybody in a lot of ways. And I do think that there is a lot of that idea that men are the aggressors. Men are, you know, men are supposed to be sexual. They're supposed to be interested in sex, which again, not all men are. So if you Right. happen to be a low interest man, that's shaming in of itself, that you're not this aggressor and this stud, you know, and this one who's going to be super into sex. But at least men, for the most part, get permission to have a sexual drive. They've just got to keep it under control, and they've got to make sure that they're not mean about it. Women have more of the message of gatekeepering for their sexual, you know, that men are going to want you for this one thing, so make sure you protect that at all costs. And so if you're a woman who actually wants to explore, that's a difficult message. And if you're a woman who doesn't really understand her sexuality very well or is low libido, then, you know, you have this kind of like, I'm going to be sleeping with the enemy the rest of my life. So we pit men and women, especially for heterosexual marriage, as enemies from the get-go. He's going to want something. You're going to have to figure out how to give it to him in a way that totally doesn't shaft you in the process. And it doesn't help neither men.
I didn't even laugh when you said shaft.
Nor women have intimate, pleasurable, healthy, egalitarian sexual experiences together that are pleasure centric. Plus, we're very goal centric as Mormons and Americans, right? So we want orgasms, we want erections, we want certain experiences to look a certain way. Hmm. We tend to think of sex as very much penis and vagina centric. And so we miss out on like tons of possibilities and creativities around our sexual pleasure that becomes very almost, I'd say like, what's the word? Almost like routined and stable and quite frankly boring.
Yes. Oh no. There's so much there about, you know, these expectations. And I can tell you from being on both sides of the fences. So dating again, when I was a single and having that experience where sex naturally comes when it naturally, and how beautiful, wonderful experience. It can still be awkward and too many elbows and knees and that sort of stuff. Yeah, that experience where it's for, you know, it's forced, and for both of us, you know, for both genders, you know, men have, for my generation, were told you can't trust yourself, you can't be around women, you can't, you know, you're going to go out of control. And women told the same thing, and it's like the opposite gender is danger; they're the devil. Everything's forbidden until right this moment, and then, because you said earlier, you were saying we say you can do or not do X, Y, Z. And unfortunately, it's not even that clear. You know, when I grew up, they talked a lot about heavy petting and necking and these euphemisms all the time. Your little factory. I spent a lot of time, like as a 12 or 13-year-old, just trying to figure out what in the world they were talking about.
Yeah, no, I agree with that.
Because they weren't very clear, which installed guilt for a lot of people because they would think they were doing something naughty when they weren't even doing anything at all, really.
Yeah, and the reality is that I don't think the church has done a good job of making anything okay, quite frankly. I mean, it just, the only reason why certain things are okay for certain people is because they personally have room for flexibility or for nuance in their own personality or their own interpretation of what the church says. But if you really look at the Standard of Youth pamphlet, I mean, the only way to be a successful non-married teen or young adult or even older adult is to be asexual, because they're not even, you know, they're saying avoid even sexual thoughts or arousals. And I've had people with OCD in my office or, you know, developmental types of disorders that take that very literally and are doing things like avoiding washing their genitals in the shower, because that would mean going against that sentence that's in the Strength for Pamphlet Youth. And we treat adults it's so fascinating to me how many times an adult has told me after a divorce or a death, and they're in their 40s, 50s, 60s, how many times they were handed the For Strength for Youth pamphlet as their new guide for sexual guidelines. And I'm like, oh, my land. Like, I mean, that just seems so crazy to me that we're treating a 55-year-old, let's say, widow the same as we would a 15-year-old adolescent as far as the expectations for sexual purity. So we don't really offer any leeway for people to have any spectrum on sexual development or growth. And this is what differs. I think this is why it differs even in countries. You know, the Europeans, for example, the progressive Europeans like Netherlands and I forget which countries have the really great research on comprehensive sexual education. It's not that their kids are not being sexual. It's not. They're being sexual at the same ages that our kids are being sexual, but they are avoiding penis and vagina penetration. They're avoiding penis and anus intercourse. They're avoiding risky behaviors. They're doing things like dry humping, giving hand jobs, giving oral sex, or, you know, receiving oral sex in ways that are protective from STIs much better than our kids are doing. So we as a culture, as an American culture, as a Christian culture, and definitely as a Mormon culture, have no room for anything outside of maybe, you know, eye gazing, holding hands, a small kiss, even like heavy making out, like where there's lots of tongue action. You start getting Mormons a little squirmy about whether or not that's okay to be doing. So we don't have enough spectrum between pre-marriage to post-marriage to offer any type of sexual development at all.
Well, and we're walking this path again. You know, Mormons are trying to become more inclusive for the LGBT community. And, you know, you hear a lot of lip service around, well, you can come to church, you can be an active participant, you just can't consummate your homosexuality. And whenever I'm having a discussion, I always ask the LDS person the same thing. So can two gay men hold hands and scratch each other's back in church? And the answer is always uncomfortable. Exactly. If you're really forced, and they say no.
Exactly.
So we arrest the sexuality of heterosexuals, and we take five steps backwards from that on for the LGBT community.
What's so insidious about how we're treating the LGBT community is that we're not really even talking about sex anymore. We're talking about any type of romantic relationship.
Or just even human touch.
Human touch, a human crush. You know, most of us as Mormons are comfortable with heterosexual crushes even from the age of 5 or 6, right? Oh, isn't that cute? Oh, that's so fun. Oh, maybe they're meant to be. You know, maybe they met before in the pre-existence or whatever. We do not offer any of that to homosexual, gay, lesbian, transgender, intersex people unless they fit the, you know, classic bisexual mode where nobody just knows. Nobody knows that they're bisexual or things of that nature. So we are robbing them of every form of natural connection that we are all seeking pretty much from a very early age. We pretend that we're in relationships, you know, from the time that we're like 3, 4, 5. You know, you see little kids pretending that they're married to their mom or dad, or pretending that they're, you know, hugging or kissing a peer, or because that's driven into us, like you said, from a very evolutionary perspective, that drive to mate, that drive to love, that drive to be connected with a primary partner. And that's not even something. So this lip service that we're giving to LGBTQ plus people is so, so passive aggressive. Mm. So, you know, just this, it's, I hate to even use the word microaggression because it doesn't even feel micro to me. It feels quite macro. It's just like, we love you, and yet you're expected to function in dramatically different ways than the rest of us. And then LDS people are like, no, all we're asking them to do is not have sex. And that's not accurate at all. And even that is awful. Even that is awful to expect people to not ever have a sexual relationship in their entire life, which is the only way that you can be a worthy LGBT, well, I will say LGB person who happens to be attracted to somebody.
Yeah, there's no T's are allowed.
Yeah, well, T's at least, the only thing that's been happening well, the only thing I've liked coming out of Oak's mouth recently was we don't know that much about transsexuals. So, or, you know, so I'm like, well, at least you're not putting your foot in your mouth. So at least you can say you don't know something. That's good.
All right, so let's go back to we lead all this up to kind of the people starting to date, and I mentioned there were three models that the people tend to pursue as they start legitimately dating. Legitimately mean in an allowed way by the LDS faith. One is very short engagements. You know, then this would be couples that have kind of a normal sex drive. They're all over each other. And we'll put aside the issue of that oftentimes these two are not experienced sexually or in a relationship, so they kind of don't know what they're looking for. So that's model one. Model two is you just go ahead and take the plunge and you're sexual and you wait a year or you lie. I'm surprised have I been on the church, how many people did actually just, and I don't condemn that as a strategy. It was just more common than I thought it was. Or the third one is they date for a normal amount of time, i.e. a few years, and they stay celibate. I mean, those are really your only three options, right? And all three of them are fraught. And you know, we've talked before. I've talked before on the podcast. We've had episodes on short-term marriages. They have problems because you really can't get to know somebody in the same time frame that your genitals want to get to know them.
Right. Well, and before I even dive into that, I just want to apologize. I think I said transsexual instead of transgender. So I think Oaks was talking about transgender folks. So I apologize for that.
You look pretty righteous, so I'm not sure you're going to understand this simile. But most podcasts are like beer. You have to drink a lot to get that buzz. The Sunstone Magazine podcast, on the other hand, is like whiskey. Small glass, big buzz. That's because our podcast isn't about interviews, conversation, or witty banter. Rather, it presents audible quality recordings of Sunstone's best articles, essays, fiction, and poetry. Do you want to hear what the best LDS minds have to say when they say it perfectly? Then this podcast is for you. Listen to some of our free episodes at patreon.com/sunstone, and then join us for a weekly shot of the best of Mormon thought and experience. And yes, you'll be able to drive home safely afterward and get a temp recommend if you want.
So when we interfere with anything that's kind of wired within us, there's probably going to be issues. And that's in any area of life, but specifically in sexuality. One of the things that I'm not sure you have even addressed yet that I've seen quite a bit of is because we have such a fear-driven response around sexual chemistry and sexuality, I've seen a lot of people actually tell me, you know, I actually avoided the person that I had sexual chemistry with. Like, we made out for a few times, I could tell that it was super hot. And this now the interpretation that those young people are thinking is, this is not good for me. This will take me to bad places. So I'm going to break up with this person, or, you know, and choose the safer route, which is usually somebody that they have less sexual chemistry with, which in that moment maybe feels very pure and virtuous given the context of the culture. And yet we are now having a disaster on our hands, you know, 20, 30 years down the road. Absolutely. When people marry people who they're really not sexually compatible with. So that's a dramatic thing that I've noticed.
It is. And before we move on to the next one, there's a dark side to that. And I've talked to many people who experience this. So the way we're framing it out is that people were conditioned when they felt lust for somebody they loved to think that that was sinful, that there was something wrong in the relationship.
Not only that it was actually called not being loving. Ooh. I remember talks like that. Like, if you lust over somebody, that's actually you not being loving towards this person. So again, it demonizes the sexual chemistry and attraction and hotness that we call now in the psychology field the stage of limerence where yes. You are supposed to be feeling those kinds of feelings because you only get to feel them actually for so long. Like, those feelings don't actually last
usually
forever.
Less than 2 years.
Yeah, so about 6 to 18 months is typical for those feelings to kind of bloom and thrive and be you know, shaking around
and
your
hormones.
And
that's that feeling where you just can't get enough of the other person.
Can't get enough
You're
of
just
them.
Obsessed about them. You're thinking about them, the way they smell, the way they laugh, the way they talk, the way they spit food out of their mouth. Everything is just wonderful.
You can barely go to school. You can barely go to work. Every love song has got you feeling amazing. Every waking moment, you're either spending it with them or thinking about them. Any critique from any other person is like crazy, right? Like parents who are like, I don't know about this guy or this lady. And you're like, whatever, this person is amazing. So you're super defensive. You're super into them. And a huge part of that is the sexual chemistry. You can make out for hours. You can touch each other. If you're having sex, it's like super, you know, orgasmic and fun. And that lasts for about 6 to 18 months. And that's a very important phase to enjoy and go through with somebody, because when that phase finishes and you want to have a long-term relationship with that person, it's not that you can't ever enjoy those types of feelings again, but they are like kind of, they reside within your memory bank, in your body and in your brain, so that you can tap back into them.
They surface occasionally, but not as a consistent, constant interruption.
And that's why people, who've been married 20, 30, 50 years can still have very passionate, very exciting, very cool feelings towards one another and have hot sex together, because they had that moment, those moments of limerence that helped create that kind of like foundation, that fire, right? I often tell people, well, if there was a fire, I can help you restoke the fire. I can't create a fire out of nothing.
And if we look at kind of current research, if I'm saying this correctly, it's a relationship is kind of like shifting through gears in a car. You know, at gear one, you see somebody, you're attracted to them, you're attracted to their mind, and then you find out there's mutual attraction. Gear two, you go into this limerence phase, and during that phase gives you enough time for attachment theory to actually pair bond with the person. So that starts to decline, and you become more rational again to function the rest of the world. And then ideally, then the pair bond has sort of cemented in.
Exactly.
Am I saying that correctly?
Yeah, exactly. That's a very good metaphor. And so then when we interfere in that space as ecclesiastical leaders or as parents, because we're seeing this happen in front of us, right? We're scared that they're going to be having sex or getting pregnant or all these things that we're super afraid of. So we interfere with that. And then we conflate and we mischaracterize these things, like separating lust from love does a huge disservice to really understanding sensual connection, which includes both love and lust. And those are actually very normal things that we're wired for very specific reasons. And they actually help monogamy and they help long-term relationships. So what drives me crazy as, you know, somebody who works within the Mormon population is any time that we're doing things that I know have a bad effect on what we actually want. Like I know as Mormons, we typically want people to have successful long-term monogamous relationships, and yet we make it very difficult to have that happen, right? Or we want people to not look at pornography. Well, we make it very difficult for that not to happen in how we have our discussions around sexual anxiety, fear, and it's a very fear-driven response. And anytime you introduce fear to the equation, then now you have an anxiety feedback loop. And anytime you're in an anxiety feedback loop, you're not really in a space of authenticity. You're not in a space of wellness. You're not in a space of really developing the types of skills you need for long-term relationships.
All this is true. And the dark thing that I was hinting at before that's related to this is I'm hoping the church isn't doing this as much now, but they might still be. It was oftentimes a requirement of the repentance process. So two people in limerence, in love, in sexual bloom would do something. They may not even have intercourse. They would do something and they would confess it to the bishops. And I can't tell you how many times I've heard the story, I'm sure you have, where the bishop said as a condition of their repentance, they had to stop seeing one another.
Right.
And underlying that is this Mormon paradigm, and it's of course an American paradigm, that sex is something you take from somebody else. Mm. So I know women who confess to their bishop and, you know, that they had gotten hot heavy with a man, and then they were shamed that they had interfered with his priesthood. They'd taken something away from him. In a normal, healthy relationship, sex is a synergy sort of thing. It's we come together and then we create something bigger than both of us.
Well, and even the language that we have in the wider culture of losing your virginity, you know, is a loss. It's something as seen as like you're saying, either something that's taken away or that you've left somewhere. You're trying to refind it.
Even the concept of virginity, there's no such thing.
Exactly. It's so difficult to kind of, you know, weave out all of these ideas that have been, you know, infiltrated and indoctrinated into us from very early ages, both from the outside culture and also within Mormonism. And so I really like language that I've heard from like Al Vernacchio and Doug Braun Harvey that have to do with like your sexual debut, you know, your sexual debut, and instead of a loss of something. Because I've also heard LDS women who actually did wait to have sex until after marriage, and they still felt a loss of that idea of, you know, I had something of worth and of value and of virtue.
Well, all their identity in young women's was around not giving it up.
About not having sex. And so even in spaces where you know, where we would sanctify sex religiously, they still feel a loss. Like, now I'm no longer that special, pure, virginal, you know, young woman that my whole identity has been centered around. So you can see how creating identity around certain sexual behaviors can be so harmful for so many people. Not to mention, of course, the even further complication of sexual trauma and how so many people see behaviors that have happened through sexual assault as part of losing their virginity or losing their virtue, and how we have very little resources as a religious community to help people through sexual traumatic
experiences. Well, and we induce the trauma. I mean, I know many people, and I'm sure you've talked to many, who their sexual experience was good, beautiful, organic. They woke up the next day feeling guilty, and they went in and were traumatized by the bishop.
Yes.
And for those people very close to me who were dating normally, that happened, and then they went even years without even going out on a date.
Yeah.
Because they felt even though they might have repented, they still felt unworthy. They didn't trust themselves. They didn't want to destroy anybody else.
Yes.
And there's people who went into their whole life as spinsters. What's the male term for a spinster?
I don't know, 40-year-old virgin.
It's an old-fashioned term and probably sexist, so I apologize. But you know, they would go into that and never, and we've got this problem now where we enter porn into the mix. Now there was porn available when I was young, but it was hard. You had to work for it. You had to really earn that stuff. But now it's in such a wash. So I see from the masculine side where oftentimes young men will maybe get too hot and heavy with a young lady. They need to repent, and then they don't feel worthy. But they go. Their biology wants an outlet, and porn is such a readily available sexual outlet. Then they hit porn again, and then they go down into this cycle. And then you've got a whole bunch of young women who've been taught basically to police men's sexuality and porn use, and taught that if they use porn, even if they use porn before they got in a relationship, it was an infidelity to them. And you've got this weird dance where people want that connection, they want the sexuality, but they can't get there because, as you brilliantly point out, it was interrupted by the church.
Right, right. Yeah, there's so many things I could pick out from what you've said. I mean, I'll share a little bit just personally, which if anybody's interested in going in depth into my personal story, I did an interview with John Belen over at Mormon Stories about my personal kind of sex story through Mormonism. But I kind of came up with this little TED Talk-ish talk that I wrote about how premarital sex ruined me. But the play on words there is that it wasn't so much the premarital sex that ruined me. It was the stories told to me about premarital sex. Mm. So when I really think back now in a much different lens, being able to look back at my teenage self and the sexual experiences that I had with a boyfriend I loved and felt very comfortable with and who was nothing but wonderful as far as consent and non-exploitation and all that, I actually had a very beautiful experience that I could not see as beautiful because of the lens that I was under through my Mormon upbringing. And so it interfered even with something that I was told how to feel about, right? And I think that's how a lot of us are functioning in our sexuality, whether it's finding out my spouse is looking at erotic imagery, or finding out that my spouse masturbates, or finding, or how I feel about my own sexuality and whether or not I masturbate in a long-term marriage, or whether or not I've had premarital experiences, or things that I fantasize about that I would never tell anybody. All of these things have stories that are intricately connected with our identities because of what we've been told to think and how to feel about them, instead of really having the freedom to figure out what that is for us ourselves, what our sexual values are, what our sexual preferences are, what our sexual stories are going to mean to us. And in the context of Mormonism, you know, I love to pick out abstract doctrine that just speaks to me. There's something beautiful about personal revelation to me, you know, even in an abstract way, that, and personal authority, that we have some inkling of that in our Mormon theology. That means we can have the right to our own personal experience with anything from the divine to our sexuality to our interpretations about things. And I just think it's very oppressive when older people, cultures, religions force stories down our throats that are not to our benefit.
So true. And that's a great transition. We've kind of painted a doom and gloomy picture of the state of affairs. But there's hope.
There is hope. And there's orgasm. And there's clitorises.
And there's hope
female pleasure.
At all ages. You know, that sexuality can bloom and does bloom for people. I've met women, for example, who became very comfortable and open into their sexuality postmenopausal. That phase in their life didn't open until their 50s or 60s or 70s. That we can, sexuality can be a part of all. It doesn't matter what's happened to you in the past. It can be overcome. And you're here to tell us that's true.
Yes, our brains are plastic. I mean, the only thing that you really have hardwired within you is survival. Everything else is plastic, you know? And we know that connection is part of survival, and we know that pleasure is part of our capacity. And I mean, there's nothing that makes me happier in my work as a sex therapist is to help people through these messages, understand how they've impacted them, help them practice new ways. Because again, it's not just a cerebral process. You know, many of us can listen to a podcast, for example, and get a new idea and go, huh, you know, I think I agree with that, or I can see how that maybe hurt me, or yes, I, you know, that resonates with my story. But that's just the first step. I mean, the real space where the rubber hits the road on change and you know, experiencing something different is when you're willing to take some of these concepts and practice something different. And at first, that's going to feel awkward and corny and maybe a little uncomfortable, which, I mean, if you think about it, that's probably what our first kisses all felt like. A little corny, a little uncomfortable, a little sloppy, maybe. But in that process of practicing, we get better at it and we get good at it. And over time, it just becomes our new norm. And I love doing that work with people, and especially with people that I feel like have a lot of sexual potential. It really breaks my heart how many women I hear come into my office saying, I wonder if I'm asexual. And not that there's anything wrong with being asexual, but I'm telling you that the percentage of Mormon women that come into my office asking that question does not correlate with what we know statistically about an asexual population, which is actually a very small part of the population. What I really think is happening is that they've never been allowed to understand their own pleasure potential, never understood themselves as sexual creatures or taught to be sexual creatures. And they are in a space where sex in general has been not enjoyable, has been a duty, a chore, has been uncomfortable, even painful, has been all about other people and having other people, birthing, and it's been very little about their own capacity for energy, synergy, and pleasure. So helping women through that is some of my favorite work. And men too, because men oftentimes, like you say, Mormon men are suffering from these messages, and many of them, even if they are more in touch with their sexuality, are at a loss as to help their wives, are at a loss of, you know, like, the last thing I want to do is pressure my wife to do something she doesn't want to do. We have a lot of really great Mormon men who are not, you know, wanting to just take advantage of patriarchal kind of dynamics, but they're confused, hurt, rejected, feeling alone, not knowing how to manage what has really become sexless marriages in many occasions. So there's so much pain everywhere, and we're sleeping with each other, and we're having babies with each other, and we're sharing lives together, and we are ill-equipped in some of the most basic ways to connect with one another. And I just think that's a tragedy that I hope people will prioritize in their lives and get help for.
But and I've read and met people, and you were saying this, that have got overcome this, that have gone from a complete deathbed, even for years, to being sexually all over each other. And sex is like anything else that we do. It takes practice. It takes a certain amount of skill. And there's a huge variety of what is sexual and what is available. So there's going to be people listening who are uncomfortable going and talking to a therapist. I mean, that's the best advice is talk to somebody who's certified. But what kind of resources or maybe a couple of books that you would recommend that people can read that might help things out?
Yeah, so there's a lot of good stuff, and I'll just say too that on my NatashaParker.org page, I do have a recommendations list for a lot of different mental health concerns, but definitely a lot of sexual books that I would refer to. I think some that are very popular today, one that a lot of women in particular are finding useful is Come As You Are by Emily Nagoski, Becoming Clitorate by Dr. Laurie Mintz. There are... some one Sexual Matters for Men. There's just a lot of good stuff out there. So check out my recommendations page. I also have created a podcast called Mormon Sex Info, where I actually interview a lot of these authors. Like I have interviewed Emily Nagoski and Laurie Mintz and many others talking about some of these issues that have to do with sexual shame. And they are more than excited to be able to reach out to an audience that is, you know, Mormon, and of course, in my view, that's a very spectrumed audience from believers to non-believers to in between. Very, very fascinating interviews with them. So check out that resource. And then what I'm currently very much developing right now after doing a survey where I got some really interesting feedback about sexual shame and how it's affecting specifically heterosexual couples is I'm creating an online course called flourishintimately.com. So the first part of that course will actually be offered for free this coming week. It's all online. I know it can be hard to pick up the phone or go into an office and see a sex therapist. So there are a lot of resources online that you can do from the comfort and privacy of your own home. If that's a good place to start, then you may check out some of the resources that I'm trying to develop for those reasons.
Well, fantastic. And then last thing I would say for all of us is we can be more tolerant and check our language. There's a lot of times that I find, even today, myself saying things that are passively aggressively male shaming or female shaming and just recognize that it's just such a wonderful part of who we are, being human. And there's people who take all sorts of different paths. And, you know, as long as they're not hurting society or doing a lot of damage to themselves, and of course we have to redefine what damage means, because in the mm-hmm. church we've defined damage into existing mm-hmm. where it didn't exist before. Mm-hmm. But I think we all can find ways to be more inclusive and more supportive of those around us.
I would agree. Inclusiveness and watching the stories that we tell, not to just assume that there's damage or oppression when you really need to be curious about those things. You know, again, I would have probably said I was damaged and oppressed, and now I'm like, actually, I was fine, but that was a story that was told to me about how I should feel about myself for things that actually were quite pleasurable and wonderful. So watch your stories, be inclusive, be open to new ideas and learning, check your own authority with yourself, figure out what your potential is, and get the resources that you need to do so. It's not something that we can always do alone.
And sex is fun, it's joyful, it's connective, it's tender, it's emotional, it's silly. it's a game that adults play. And I think when we recognize that complexity of it and can just let go of just constantly putting it in darkness, then that in itself lightens the whole thing up.
Yeah, so I love that, John. That was a really nice ending. And I would say it's good for your health. It's good for your health.
Yeah, it's what you're supposed to do. That's what you were designed to do, whether you believe it was God or now that doesn't mean you have a blank check, but you know, find the right place, find the right people, and it can be so wonderful.
Yes, like all the other things that we're wired to do. Eating can be done in wonderful ways and in harmful ways. Sleeping can be done in wonderful ways and restorative ways and in harmful ways. So yes, sexuality is something that's innate to most of us. Most of us want a relationship with it. Let's figure out how to do it well. Let's flourish. Let's thrive. Let's do good by ourselves and each other.
Well, Natasha, it was a pleasure. I look forward to the next time I can hear you speak. And I'll give you out your website one more time.
NatashaParker.org, SymmetrySouls.com. Either one of those, you can check out what I'm up to.
Excellent. Thank you so much.
Thank you, John.